Accession number 30419, reel 2.
Do you know, I don't think I can remember any of them to these days, but the Black Flag was the one that that I do remember, because if there was a Black Flag up, the weather was too bad to do any flying. And later on, that became quite important when I was at Cranwell. So I can remember Black Flag. There were signals for if there was parachute dropping going on in the facility. There were signals for I can't remember much else really. Of course, there was a windsock that was very important, and there was a tee, and the tee that was laid out gave you the direction of takeoff and landing. So that was important when you were coming back to the airfield. You had to look at the signals when you got back to the airfield, because the wind might have changed.
So they were your basics.
Yes.
So you're clambering into the Tiger Moth.
Yeah. So when you get into the Tiger Moth, you've had a look at the cockpit before. You've had a good look round the aeroplane before, of course. But the first flight, magical. The drill is that you have some ignition switches outside, which are up for on and down for off, and you put them both on, and you say contact, and the guy swings the propeller. You've got to have the stick right back so that the elevators are up to keep the tail down. Excuse me. You've got chocks under the wheels, of course, no brakes on the Tiger Moth. And I think, yeah, the first thing they do is suck in. That's right. You have the switches down, and the guy swings the propeller two or three turns, right-hand tractor, so he pulls it down on the right like that, with the switches off. It's quite important to have the switches off then, so you say switches off, because if it leaps into life when the guy isn't expecting it, he's in trouble. And then you say switches on, contact, and he swings it and it starts. Tremendous moment. Because you feel the vibration of the engine through the fuselage, and the wind starts blowing in your face straight away. Smell of oil, petrol, marvellous. And the air corkscrews down the fuselage, the left-hand tractor, so it comes in on the right cheek, which you have to remember later on when you're being sick. Because if you're sick over on the right, you're in trouble. And
it all comes back
at you. And then you do a power check. You let the engine warm up. And then you open the throttle, full power. Things juddering. You've got the stick back, so it stays on the ground. But there's a tremendous, exciting sort of feeling. Again, like sitting on a motorbike. Check your temperatures and pressures, make sure that everything's fine, and then throttle back, wave the chocks away, and the guy has to remember to come back behind the prop to take the chocks out, and then he makes a signal that the chocks are away, and you taxi out.
Taxiing
I loved. Well, I think probably it's much because you've only got the two dimensions to worry about, I think, and so it's more relaxing. It can't go up and down if you're lucky. But the Tiger Moth, you've got a very high nose, so you have to weave from side to side constantly, full left rudder and round you go, full right rudder and round you go. So you steer on the rudders, and there's something rather nice. I mean, I had never driven a motor car. I'd never ridden a motorbike, so this was the first time I was in charge of or trying to do something with a mechanical engine, a vehicle, and I'm not sure whether on the first flight I did much myself, but you followed through. The instructor would say, "Follow me through," so you put your feet on the pedals and sense what he was doing all the time. Out to the takeoff point, then you do your pre-takeoff checks, which is, I can still remember, TTMFIHH, trim, temperatures, mixture rich, throttle friction nut tight, instruments, harness and hood.
Oh well.
And the hood would be if you were doing instrument flying, but I'm wrong. The hood were the doors on the side of the aeroplane. And you had to check that you had enough fuel. Fuel was the other F for fuel. F for friction nut, F for fuel. And then you'd watch. You wouldn't... I don't think you got a green light or anything like that from the tower. You just made sure that there was nothing on the approach and then turned onto the takeoff path. Full throttle, with the stick still back in your stomach, and keeping the nose straight. When you open the throttle fully on a piston airplane, you get the torque from the propeller throwing you to one side. So you had to put on a little bit of rudder. Can't remember whether it's left or right. But I would if I was in a Tiger Moth, I think, because it's such an evident push to the side. So you have to keep it straight, which a lot of people found quite difficult. And I expect I did from time to time. And then did you just sense that the thing's getting lighter, so you then push the stick forward and bring the tail up, not too far forward. If you go too far forward, you jam your prop into the ground, and then you're in trouble. So just to get the tail up, and you're flying along on the two wheels. And then at about 47 knots, I think it was, or was it 37? It was really about the speed that you do in your motor car in the road outside here. You took off. And the airfield was quite bumpy, all that bumping stopped and you were floating, you were up. Climbed to 400 feet, keeping it straight, then throttled back for the climb. I think it was 1950 revs for the climb. And flew away, with the Surrey countryside dropping away beneath you. On that first flight, we would then fly down the railway line to Brookwood Cemetery, which had a tower on it and was a landmark, and turn to the general flying area, which was down north of Guildford, and he would have shown effective controls, which was your first chance, because he would give you control in order to see what happened when you put the stick to left or right, put it forward, put it back.
And can you remember that? Can you remember the first time you were given control?
Oh, yeah, very much so.
What happened?
Well, the old Tiger Moth, if you leave it alone, it's quite happy. It'll go straight and level, really. So if it's trimmed properly, and, of course, the instructor had set up the trim. And so you would have to do something pretty crass to get in trouble. So you could really just... You held the top of the stick, which was just straight up, with a little button on top for transmitting. No, there couldn't have been a button for transmitting, what I'm talking about. Little stick, and you held it almost as if you got a pen like this and just hold it from the top. You could be very gentle with it. And you could feel the pressure of the air over the controls. So you very quickly got to understand what this little aeroplane would do if you told it to. And if you went into a turn, you have to put the rudder on into the turn to balance the aeroplane up. And it was pretty obvious if you weren't balanced up, because you'd sideslip. And the air, instead of just coming straight down the fuselage, would come in from the side. So, and you've got a very good horizon. You've got, I sat in the back seat, the instructor in the front seat, and you've got the biplane wing. So you can see the horizon between the biplane wings. So that was all right. I don't think we did too much more. We then turned, and I think probably I did the turn. But of course, he was very close on the controls with you.
So how did you do the turn? What was the process for the turn?
You put the stick to the... If you want to turn left, you put the stick to the left and a bit of left rudder. If it's a steeper turn, you've got to lift the nose. You've got to hold the nose up. Because if you turn an aeroplane, it will naturally spiral down. So you've got to use the elevators to keep the nose up. If it's a really steep turn, you've got to use the rudder to keep the nose up, because the rudder becomes part of the elevator, if you see what I mean, if you're right on the side. But we didn't do any steep turns on this first flight, nor any aerobatics. When I became an instructor later on, I realised, I remember those Tiger Moth flights now at cadet camp. Almost every time it would be a fellow probably on a ground tour who was delighted to take the cadets up to get some flying in. And immediately you'd taken off, want to see any aerobatics? And of course, some people, I suppose, that's all they wanted to do, but I was terrified. Not much terrified, I was sick. And I found it all very disorientating. So old Ron Cobbett didn't do any of that on the first flight. It was very straightforward and gentle, effect and use of controls and air familiarisation. We came back into the circuit, flying up the railway line on the right-hand side, with passing Brookwood Cemetery down on the left. There were a few macabre jokes about that cemetery. And then we came overhead at 1,500 feet. London Airport's not very far away, and it was beginning to build up London Airport. That's another thing I did. I used to go airplane spotting with a chum of mine from school. We used to go to Heathrow Airport when it was still just some sheds on the north side, and watch all these DC-4s and Dakotas and Airspeed Ambassador Elizabethans, and that's another thing which gave me the flying bug. That's right, I've forgotten about that.
I can't imagine Heathrow or the early days of Heathrow.
Yeah,
very different.
Oh, after the war, it was just my wife was an air hostess, and in the 60s, it was still just sheds on the north side, and she. And anyway, this first flight, we couldn't go. We had to keep down fairly low coming over Fair Oaks and go out to Brookwood, because if we went the other way, we got in snarled up with London Airport. And we joined the circuit. Downwind checks, which are pretty similar to takeoff checks. Turn crosswind. And throttle back and let down, turn at about 500 feet on finals, fixed undercarriage, didn't have to worry about that, and then there's nothing quite so pleasant, I think, in flying as throttling back in a Tiger Moth and gliding it down. It's the most wonderful sound of this engine chug chug chugging in front. You can hear the swish of the propeller. You can hear all the rigging wires singing. Some of the models have slats, which are automatic slats, which are extra lift devices, and they clunk in and out. It's the most wonderful, wonderful feeling, especially if you need to lose some height. We didn't do this on the first flight, but it's the thing that I loved to do, was to side slip in. So you'd basically reverse the controls. You put the stick forward and to the left and right hand rudder, and then you side slip to the left, and you could look out and see the place you wanted to land, particularly important for force landing. And so down you come down steeper. You lose a lot more height that way. You have to watch out for the stall, of course. If you stalled it in that configuration, you'd spin straight in, which one bloke did. And the but then, just as you come over the threshold, and just before landing, you kick it all off the other way. You put centralise the rudders, centralise the stick, ease back, and slide it in on 3 points. Fantastic. There's nothing like it. We didn't do that on the first flight.
No.
But we did on a few flights in. And then taxi back to the dispersal, zigzagging. I think on the way back he must have let me do the taxiing. In fact, I'm sure he did, which was a great boost to confidence. Because you bring it into line and the ground crew man standing there with the chocks, and you just basically switch off the switches and everything stops.
And you clambered out.
Clambered
you're
out.
You're in your new flying gear.
In my new flying gear, and I hadn't been sick on that flight, and I felt $1 million, or £1,000, let's make it currency of the time. Yeah, so so we did another 30-odd hours of that, and it was really quite an extraordinary thing. The highlights, and I've got my logbook here, were the landing away cross countries.
Tell me about those.
Yes, after I went solo. After, there it is, first solo. I mean, that's the first thing, though, that I'll tell you about. I'd done 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. It's my 13th flight. God, I've only just realised that. 10 minutes, Fair Oaks Local. Now, that was really something quite special, the first solo. Because this was really the key point. A lot of guys didn't make it to first solo. The most likely thing was they couldn't judge their height over the ground, which was disastrous. One guy did spin in with his instructor, trying too hard on the. It was all right. They walked out the wreckage and went to the pub. Tiger Moth was very forgiving in that sense. Another one I can remember landing in the top of a tree, and the two blokes climbed down the tree, so there were no fatalities, but there were some accidents. So I got through this, and the one thing I do remember most about it was the instructor landing after we'd done 45 minutes of circuits, and he landed, and the instructor got out of the front seat and said, right, you're on your own. And he went and stood by the threshold with his cushions, seat cushions, on his head, which is fairly comic, but this was a signal to all the other planes in the area that it was a first solo. And I took off, and I went round, and I came back, and I landed. And I have to say, Kathy, I don't remember too much about it, but it was the most wonderful moment. And after it, Ron Cobbett got back in the aeroplane and we took off, and he did the most extraordinary beat up of the airfield. Extraordinary. I don't know enough about Ron Cobbett, but I think he must have been a fighter pilot, because we went through the hangars, between the two hangars, with the wings vertical. It was extraordinary. I didn't feel in any danger at any time, but he did the most. With that Tiger Moth, he made it do things which I've never managed to do. And then after another 20 hours or so, first solo cross-country, and it says here, Fair Oaks to Alton to Dorking to Fair Oaks. And I flew a little aeroplane all by myself to other places, on the 10th of September 1957. So I was 17 and a half. And then the final cross-country on the 15th of September, Fair Oaks, White Waltham, where I landed, Kidlington, where I landed, and back to Fair Oaks. And this was a return via Grove. And this was another magnificent exercise. I remember at White Waltham, where I later became an instructor, bouncing three or four times. And
what
I got.
What do you do when you bounce?
Well, I'm not really certain. I think you probably just hang on and hope it sorts itself out. It was quite easy to bounce on a tiger moth if you didn't get. You had two ways of landing, proper ways. You could do a wheeler, which meant that you land with the tail up and put the main wheels down, and as the speed drops off, you let the tail go back, which is the way they do it these days, because it's far less risky for the aeroplane. They don't have many tiger moths. But in those days, we always tried for three-pointers, which was the way you come in just above the stall and you stall as you land. With the tail down, you land on 3 points at once. Well, I got somewhere in between at White Waltham, and so it's actually quite hazardous because you bounced, but you haven't got the airspeed to go around again, unless you're very lucky, so you have to come down again. So I bounced several times, but I got it right at Kidlington, I can remember, and got back to Fair Oaks, and then five flights later, it was this final handling test for license with Wing Commander Arthur, and it says satisfactory, Arthur CFI in my logbook.
Can you talk me through some of the stages along the way? So some of the different things you're learning at different points in over those 30 hours.
Yes, if you hold on a moment, I've got my chipmunk Flying Instructor's Handbook there. Right. This is the Central Flying School Flying Instructor's Handbook, and it was published in 59. So that would have been about what we were doing. And after preparation for flight, effects of controls, taxiing, and the familiarisation was what I've just talked about. Mm-hmm. Then you straight and level flight, which takes actually a lesson on its own.
Tell me about that.
Well, it's to demonstrate straight and level flight at cruising speed. This is the chipmunk, where that was 90 knots, about the same in the tiger moth. And you've got to stress as an instructor and learn as the pupil, first of all, the importance of lookout. Now, most of the flying that I've done has been visual and not along airways, not under air traffic control. And so you are responsible for yourself, for your own safety and everybody else's safety. So it's terribly important to look out. The bomber pilots in the war and a lot of the fighter pilots used to wear silk scarves. People thought that was an affectation. It isn't. It's to stop your neck getting sore, because as a pilot, your head is constantly going through 360 degrees if you can manage it. Especially a fighter pilot, he has to look behind a lot. So you're constantly weaving your head around, looking out and not at the instruments at all. Then you come back and check the instruments. So the important thing is to keep a good lookout. And you've got to keep constant altitude and direction and balance. That's what it says here, and that's what flying straight and level is all about.
So why does that take a lesson?
Well, then you've got to do straight and level flight at various power settings, and that makes a big difference. If you open the throttle, you've got that torque that I mentioned about. Also, if you open the throttle and do nothing else, the airplane will climb, because the airspeed over the wings increases, the lift increases, you go up. So you've got to trim forward for that. You've got to trim the elevator forward for that. And then you've got to do it also at different... If you close the throttle, the opposite applies. So you've got to be able to do that and keep the height constant. That's what straight and level means. And then there's different airspeeds. If you want to fly at 90 knots, it's a different set of trim settings than if you're flying at 110 knots. So that takes a 40-minute lesson, 40, 45-minute lessons. I think generally speaking, with a new student, you don't want to fly for longer than that. It's very tiring, concentrating, different environment, and there's always the tendency to air sickness. So you want to get them back. As a student, you want to get back before you throw up. I mean, there's always... It looks, doesn't it, from the ground so smooth, but it's always very lumpy in the air. Especially at lower altitudes, you get thermals, you get wind climbing off hills, so it's always very bumpy.
So is there a trick to dealing with air sickness?
Well, yes. I have found that I was always air sick when I was at Cranwell, first flight or two back after a vacation. So if you're lucky. If you're lucky, you don't get airsick at all. There are supermen who don't. I used to find that after two or three flights, I was all right. A lot of it is to do with the ears. And so they get used to the difference of different attitudes, and you're all right. And, of course, you have to be sick. I mean, so people recognise, and flying instructors understand that with new students. And with a tiger moth, over the left-hand side. Then you do climbing and descending, which is always very important to keep the speeds right. I'm a most meticulous driver these days, Cathy. I'm the only bloke in England who obeys the speed limits, I think, because I can hear my instructor's voice in my ears. Watch your speeds! Watch your speeds! And medium turns, which are different from what comes next, which is steep turns.
So tell me about the differences in terms of what you're doing.
Yes. Well, if you... A medium turn is really... All about attitude. Well, look out first of all. You shouldn't turn an aeroplane until you're absolutely certain that it's clear the place you're turning to. And you've got to make sure that you keep the wings, the horizon constant. You've got to keep the nose in the same place on the horizon if you possibly can. In a medium turn, that's not so difficult. And then you've got to remember your orientation. Remember the poor fellow who drove round and round the M25 about 12 times before he got off it? I remember that terrible in the early days, the M25. Well, similar with a turn. You've got to keep a note of where you are in relation to the terrain so that you know when to stop the turn. Steep turns, different again. If they're really steep, as I said earlier, you've got the controls coming different. If straight and level flight, the aerolons control your attitude left and right. When you're in a very steep turn, the aerolons become your elevators. Really, they don't. They still control your attitude right and left, but they're vertical. You've got to remember that, and it's the elevator at the back which becomes in effect a rudder, and your rudder becomes the elevator. So when you're in a steep turn, you've got to keep rudder on to keep the nose in the right place. And the stick is pulled right back because you're pulling G.